for any announcements he may have and for today's main message, Mr. Ron Elkins.
Thank you, RG. How special it is remains to be seen, I guess. My wife and I traveled down this morning, left about 8 o'clock, had a nice little drive down from Texarkana. The scenery is beautiful, not quite as beautiful as it was the other day. I went up to Little Rock, and there was quite a few maple trees, and the sweet gums and all those things were in full color display, and it was absolutely gorgeous. But it's a beautiful drive down here also, and it's great to be with my brothers and sisters down here in Tyler, Texas. Send you greetings from Texarkana and from the church in Little Rock and Jacksonville, and also from the Shreveport Church. And looking forward to seeing the Little Rock group next Sabbath. I'd like to say hello to all those on the tape program. If this does get out to the folks on the tape program, well, greetings from Tyler. My wife and I have been able to survive the onslaught of the sinus situations that are going around Texarkana. I don't know if it's that bad here, but down there, there are a lot of people that are suffering from that. And the thing of it is, it goes on for weeks and weeks and weeks. You think you're over it, and then it comes back. So hope everybody's been spared that. Let me get a sip of water before I start, because I feel a little bit dry. Talked to Charles the other night. He was up somewhere around Illinois, Indiana, somewhere. He was on one of his traveling expeditions, and sounded like he was in good spirits and headed back this way at some point in time. I'm not sure when, but okay, let me write that down. It's been said that knowledge is power. And certainly when I look at some of the great architects and the great engineers that have devised and planned and seen the building of great majestic buildings and skyscrapers, and there are several things that come to my mind when I think of people having that type of knowledge and at the epitome of their field, that have so much knowledge that they're the elite. When I think of the Twin Towers, I think of how magnificent those two things towered above the New York skyline. To me, it's just, I can't fathom how they could build something that would be 100-something stories tall and still be able to stay stacked on top of the other. To me, it looked like it would just collapse, which we saw that happen after the structure was damaged. But I just don't know how it stayed up there by itself. But these people are so smart, they're able to devise and to plan and to engineer these great buildings to where they stand and to actually function. Another thing that comes to my mind when I think of knowledge and the power that knowledge can bring forth to a man is the Golden Gate Bridge, which has been called one of the great wonders of the world. It's just a magnificent engineering piece of work. But even more so, I think, when I see the Hoover Dam, if anybody's ever seen that dam, it's just huge. It's massive. It's approximately 726 feet above the level of the water down below the riverbed. The thing is 1,200 some odd feet long. It has over 4 million cubic yards of concrete in it, 600 some odd feet thick at the base. The pressure per square foot at the base of the dam is 45,000 pounds per square foot. I mean, I just can't fathom something being able to actually withstand that much pressure. Maybe I should turn this thing on. Okay, there we go. But it does. And there have been people that had the power, the knowledge to be able to devise these things and see them through. And it just amazes me at the power and the knowledge they have at their command. So to say that knowledge is power, is when you look at those things, it's kind of a nil point. It is actually power. But you know, knowledge is like anything else. It has two faces, just like a coin has one side and the other side. And knowledge can be used in a manner or misapplied in a way that it's got an ugly side to it, an ugly face, a different face to it. And that's what I've titled this message today, Knowledge, Its Other Facet or Its Other Face. And as you go through the epistles of the Apostle Paul, you realize that he's going through a litany of different subjects that come up, different doctrinal theses or different ideas, different concepts that people have, and they're pushing the envelope on it. They're making issues out of things that really should be non-issues. That are matter more, as you mentioned last week in your sermon, Mr. Stinson mentioned the fact that a lot of these things are matters of a man's conscience and not a matter of for the church to say, well, you should do this way or you should do that way, or anybody else, for that matter of fact. So knowledge misapplied can be something that's not pleasant to see, it's not pleasant to view, and it's certainly not pleasant to experience. Again, I've entitled this knowledge, its other facet or other face. It's like a double-edged sword. I'll get more into that a little bit later. But first, I want to turn to the book of Matthew, 13th chapter. I want to begin in Matthew, the 13th chapter. But this idea of knowledge and what it can bring forth and what can be done with it, and magnificent works that come forth out of man's minds, able to engineer great, great, majestic buildings and structures. Matthew 13, I want to begin in verse 10. And this is similar to Mr. Stinson's sermon last week. It just so happens that he did his sermon, he started at 11 o'clock here. We started at 12:30 in Texarkana, and I guess he was probably finished by the time I started, but they were very similar sermons. But I want to look at something a little bit kind of in continuance, I guess, if you will. Not particularly on the same subject, although I will be mentioning the Sabbath, because that seems to be a burning issue with a lot of people. What you should do on the Sabbath, because after all, we're all here on the Sabbath, so we all agree that we should be here. You know, this is the Sabbath day. This is the day that God, you know, rested, and he said, you know, come and assemble, and we all believe that. We're all on the same page. Now, as to how you keep the Sabbath holy, as Mr. Stinson addressed some of that last week, we're not at all together in agreement on that, and that's okay. That's okay. And, you know, we don't have to be on the same page on every little aspect of God's Word, and the main point is that we're come together, we worship together, we fellowship together, we care for each other, we love each other, and we're not going to do anything that would destroy that fellowship. And the Apostle Paul dealt with the other side of knowledge that was a point of division in the church. And it was at the point where he was going to have to deal with it. We don't like to deal with it, as Mr. Stinson said last week. You know, you'd rather just let the issue roll out and hope that people come to the same understanding, or either okay with their particular points of belief and okay with your particular point of belief if it doesn't coincide with theirs. So that there's not a grading issue going on there, and there's not an attitude that develops between the two sides that causes divisions or schisms. Matthew 13, verse 10, disciples came to Christ here, and he says, why do you speak to them in parables? And he answered and said to them, because it is given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not given. So here, right away, we see that a certain group that God is going to call out of this world, he's going to enlighten, he's going to give them a certain amount of knowledge. And with that knowledge comes a certain power, a certain understanding, a certain authority, if you will. So right from the get-go, if a man was to be filled with that idea that, okay, I know something that you don't, okay? You know, and sometimes, before I came to church, I was acquainted with some folk in the church, and I thought they had that attitude, okay? That they were a little bit better than most folk, most commoners, or as some of the folk in my congregation used to call the other side, the heathens. They were the elite, you know, and they had certain knowledge that God had granted them, okay? And they took it to beyond where they should, because he says here, you know, it's given to you. It's not something that you work for. It's not something that you dug into. It's not something that you went to school for. You didn't, you know, you're not getting a PhD here. You know, this is something that God grants you. And verse 12 says, for whoever has, to him shall be given, and he shall have more abundance. But whosoever has not, from him shall it be taken away, even what he has. So, you know, it's if you can take this, what God gives you, if you can apply it correctly, if you can use it in your life, and you can develop, you can grow, then guess what? You get more, okay? But to him that doesn't have it, he's not going to get off the ground. You know, he's not going to advance. He's not going to be able to understand. So, you know, you can see where some people would think, well, you know, kind of like we did with kids on the schoolyard. You know, you found out something. Maybe it's about somebody else, or, you know, you found out a little piece of information, and you went up to the group of kids that you normally hang with, and you said, you know, I know something you don't. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. Because if I tell you, then you'll know as much as I do. And, you know, I had a boss at work like that, that I realized how he was before it came to the point where I was going to be the one who had to do the paperwork that was involved with the job that I had to do. And he was so insecure with his job that he would not take the time to take me to the side after we did a job and show me the paperwork aspect of our job. And so I realized that if I was going to learn it, I was going to have to learn it on my own. And so what he didn't know is that I would go around after he would turn in his paperwork, and I would look at it, and I'd get comfortable with it. I'd see it and see how he, you know, what he did, and you know, because I knew what he was going to do. I knew that some point in time when he went on vacation, he was going to call me in on that Friday, you know, inside his pickup cab there where he was doing his paperwork. And he's going to say, "Ron, I need to show you how to do this paperwork." And it's like, okay, give me a quick course here. You know, I wasn't going to comprehend it that quick. So I realized that what I needed to do is just go in and look at the paperwork and get comfortable with it and do it that way. So by the time he did what I said he was going to do, he called me in on a Friday evening and said, "Ron," said, "you know, I'm going to be on vacation next week. I think I need to show you some paperwork." I'm thinking to myself, yeah, it's a little bit late, but yeah, you should. But I was okay with that because I'd already figured out what was going to happen. But you see, some people are kind of, they get a little bit of information. They get, you know, we'll see what the Apostle Paul says about it. He says they get puffed up about it. They get a little bit vain about it. And they think they know something that you don't. So it makes them a little bit more elite, intellectually, if you will. With that in mind, let's go to 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, because there's a burning issue inside the Corinthian church. There were many issues inside the Corinthian church, but this particular issue was a point of division where there were two opposing sides that, let's just get into it and look at what happens here. I'm going to read this out of the Interlinear Bible here, which has the literal translation on the left side of the book, the King James on the right, and the original language in the center. But I like some of the wording here and the way it's translated. And so I want to open up with that in the Interlinear. 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter. I think most of us are familiar with this situation where people were eating things offered in sacrifice to idols. In the first verse of 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1. "But concerning the sacrifices to idols, we know that we all have knowledge." Knowledge puffs up. But knowledge is power. Knowledge is good, isn't it? Well, yeah, it is. But misapplied or misdirected or used in a way that is a detriment to somebody else is not good. Not good at all. He says it puffs up. Now, I looked that word up because I found it interesting that he uses that language. Puffs, knowledge puffs up. It comes from the 5448, which means a sense of blowing, you know. We've used the term here in East Texas, people are full of hot air, you know, sometimes. That's kind of where that term comes from. They're full of hot air. It also means to inflate or to make proud. Because after all, this person that Paul is talking about has got to the point where this knowledge he's been given, he thinks it's his. And he thinks he worked for it. He thinks he earned it. And he thinks he's got something that nobody else knows. And so he's going to straighten everybody out on the issue. Okay? His particular view or his particular thesis or exegesis on the subject, he's going to, you know, and that's the thing that's going on in the Corinthian church. I wish we had the other side of the letter, but we don't. But we can read between the lines, find out that there was points of division here. There was problems going on that Paul was forced to deal with, something he didn't want to. He'd rather had not had to do, but it's getting to the point where something has to be done. So this word puff up, to inflate, to make proud. It kind of reminds me of old Barney Fife. You remember Barney Fife and the Mayberry Show, Andy Griffith Show? You know, Barney get a little piece of information, and if somebody compliment him or whatever, he just kind of, he'd throw that old chest out, you know, and he'd just feel real good about himself. And it kind of, you know, this is what it's talking about here. A person gets puffed up. They get inflated, their ego. But it continues here. Verse 2, he says, if anyone thinks to know anything, he still has known nothing as he ought to know. And now the King James Version says that he knoweth nothing yet as he ought to know. But verse 3, but if anyone loves God, he has been known by him. So in other words, you know, the person that actually fulfills the law, that loves his fellow brethren, that's concerned and cares for them, it won't bring a divisive issue when it's not a non-salvational issue. You know, you could go for the Ten Commandments and you say, well, the fourth one says you got to keep the Sabbath. Okay. Yeah, we could say that's a salvational issue, you know. To be disobedient to the Ten Commandments would be going against God's Word. But as to how to exactly keep that, you know, there's lots of points of contention if you want to go that area, but we don't want to. That's what he's talking about here. If you love somebody, you're going to maybe not agree with them, but not disagree either. Because I know there's lots of things that I wouldn't do on a Sabbath that somebody else might. So that's okay. I'm cool with that. You know, a lot of things other people would do that I wouldn't do personally. You know, for me, you know, I wouldn't jog on a Sabbath. A lot of people enjoy that. To me, that's work. And not earning a living, but especially on my bad knees, arthritis in my knees, that would be a lot of work. I'd probably sweat. And I think the Sabbath means to rest. Now, that's my little deal there. And I'm not, you know, not trying to convert everybody. If you like to jog on a Sabbath, get on with it. That's between you and your God. That's a matter of a person's conscience. But for me, I wouldn't do that. I don't have any problem going out and eating on a Sabbath. Some do. It's okay. I can live with that. You know, and I wouldn't try to convert someone. And I don't think it'd do any good for them to try to convert me. Because I'm okay with it. I'm cool. It doesn't bother me. So don't try to make it bother me. Okay. A lot of things we could talk about on the Sabbath, but I don't want to get into that particular issue. But we see here that there's going to be a point of contention here that is really ugly. Now, I want to read this particular passage in 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, out of the New Living Translation. And I kind of like the way they render it here. The New Living Translation says this about the eating of things sacrificed to idol. You think that everyone should agree with your perfect knowledge. You know, most of us are okay. We understand we don't agree the same on every little situation, and we're okay with that. You know, we don't have any problems. We don't have any contentions. We don't have any, you know, animosity toward each other. But this person did, and Paul, you know, in this rendering here says, Paul says, you know, you think everybody should agree with your perfect knowledge. Says, knowledge may make us feel important. Can't even read my own notes. But it is love that really builds up the church. And after all, that's what Paul is, you know, that's his vocation, okay? That's his job. That's his work. He's trying to build. He's kind of like the architect or the engineer. He's trying to engineer, to architect, you know, to devise a church and to build it up and not to destruct it. But he says, you know, it builds the church. Anyone who claims to know it says anyone who claims to know all the answers doesn't really know much. But the person who loves God is the one God knows and cares for. Well, after all, when you think about what Christ said to the person that says, well, you know, I've come in before you and I've done all these mighty works and I've cast out demons and I've done all these things. He said, man, I don't know you. He said, depart from me, you that work lawlessness and iniquity. And sometimes we can use the good knowledge of the law, misapplied or misdirected or, you know, with wrong intentions, and actually do more to damage the church than we can to build the church. And certainly Paul, who before he was converted, did his level best to get rid of all these heretics that preached Jesus, you know. And I'm sure that was probably a underlying thing in his ministry, that he wanted to make sure he never misapplied knowledge. He never did anything that would hurt to harm the church, but he wanted to build, to strengthen, to get as far away from Saul, the old Paul, as he could. He would never think of ever doing anything to bring the church down. Never. And we realize when if you're an architect or an engineer, you can devise and you can come up with a plan to build a great structure. You know, you could never make one of those people who are involved in building the Twin Towers, the architects or the engineers, or the Hoover Dam, or the Golden Gate Bridge. You could never convince one of those people who loved the project so much and conceived the idea. You could never convince one of them to do something to bring the structure down. There are engineers, do you know this? There are engineers on the other side that can tell you just how much explosive and just where to put them to bring down any building or any structure, any bridge, any dam. You know, so knowledge is great if it's used correctly. And Paul here is going to try to give his dissertation on this particular subject and try to straighten them out as to how they should care for one another and not misapply this knowledge. It continues here by saying, verse 4, then concerning eating the things sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, you know. So we know that. And I think all of us, we know that. But the problem was there was another group that really had come out of that situation and that type of idolatry that really thought of that idol as some sort of deity still. You know, in the back of their mind, their conscience was, you know, seared to the point that they thought, well, that's a deity and these things are sacrificed to these deities and these gods. And I don't want to have anything to do with it. And I don't think you should. Paul says, you know, we know that they're not anything. We have that certain knowledge. There are some called gods, verse 5. And there are many gods and many lords, small g, small l. But to us there's one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things, and we through him. But the knowledge is not in all. But some, being conscious of the idol, eat as an idolatrous sacrifice unto now. And their conscience, being weak, is defiled. They're brought down. It's a stumbling point for them. But he says, but food will not commend us to God, for neither if we eat do we excel, or if we don't, we don't lack. It doesn't really matter. It's kind of like the issue that was brought up about circumcision. Let's don't get that one going again. Okay? You know, they brought that up before Paul. You know, some come down from Jerusalem and would bother the Gentiles about the situation. Said, you know, you really don't have salvation unless you have the covenant of the circumcision. Paul says, no, huh? No, that's not the, you know, if you've already been there and done that, you're okay with that. But if you're not, you're probably not okay with it. I wouldn't be okay with it. I don't want to go back to that, you know, and I know that that's, you know, it's a non-issue, okay? But some of them, if they preferred to do that, Paul would say, well, you know, if that's what you believe, go ahead and do it. But it's really a non-issue. Same thing here. But they were making an issue out of it. But verse 9 says, but watch lest this authority of yours become a stumbling block to the weak ones. For if anyone sees you, the one having knowledge sitting in an idol's temple, will not the weak one's conscience being built up or emboldened or encouraged to eat things sacrificed to idols? You know, you might encourage him to do so when he really shouldn't. And that is a situation about eating out on the Sabbath. You know, I don't try to encourage anybody that I know that doesn't want to do that. I would never try to encourage them. Matter of fact, I would not even bring it up. And most of the people that feel that way, that don't want to, they don't bring it up. But there's some out there that just are puffed up by the doctrinal theses and exegesis and all these things that they come up with. That they've just got to share it. They've just got to enlighten the rest of us to the point where we're on the same page. But it's not going to work. What it's going to do is to drive people apart. And the reason these things are coming up here so much lately is because it's being brought up again. It's being resurrected. It's like years ago we used to laugh about the Passover birds passing through and teaching us a better way to keep the Passover, more properly how to keep the Passover. You know, that was a big, kind of a laughable issue, but it was in a sense really something that was a divisive issue in the church, and some people left because they didn't think we kept it right. And there's some people that have stopped fellowshipping with the churches that we oversee because they just don't feel like we have it right on the Sabbath issue. And so, you know, these are points of contention that should not be, but left unchecked, they can be. He says here, continuing, said that, and your knowledge, verse 11, and on your knowledge the weak brother is destroyed, for he whom Christ died, and sinning in this way against your brothers. You know, that's what he says, you're sinning. And wounding their conscience, being weak, you sin against Christ. That's heavy. That's heavy. Now, that could be an issue, a real issue. Not the fact that they're eating or not eating is not the issue, but the attitude and the encouragement that you give somebody else to do something that's against their conscience. Now, that's a burning issue. And he says, you know, that should be avoided at all costs. He says, you know, if that's going to be an issue where it causes my brother to stumble, he says, I'll not eat flesh as long as I live. I just stop. As long as he's in the company of his fellow brethren. But if he is at his own home, I'm sure Paul would have, you know, liked a good steak. Don't we all? But he's not going to make an issue out of it and bring his fellow brethren down. Now, with that in mind, let's go to Romans, the 14th chapter, because there's another issue here that's being brought up. You know, it should not be an issue, but it was. Romans, the 14th chapter. And I'll read this out of the Interlinear Bible also. I want to pick up a few things out of this that should be noted. We're all familiar with the situation where there are some that were vegetarians and some that believe that, you know, they could eat meats if they wanted to. Actually knew they could. And, you go through this, and really, Paul's not really taking either side. Paul's the middle of the road guy. You know, it's not a deal where he's going to divide the church by taking one side or another. Now, he does say in verse 1, said, receive the one being weak in faith, not to judgments of your thoughts. He does say that. He does consider them somewhat weak in the faith, but he does not take issue with that fact. But he does take issue with the fact that the other group was trying to force things on them. Verse 2, one indeed believes to eat all things, but one, being weak, only eats vegetables. Now, the one eating, do not despise. In other words, for the guys that don't want to eat it, or the girls that don't want to eat it, don't despise the ones that are. Now, that's heavy. That's heavy language for brothers and sisters to despise one another. Now, my notes on this came from the World Book Encyclopedia. To despise means contempt. It can include resentment. It can include being... And when you think about resentment, what is that? Well, somebody has been... In their eyes, they have been slighted. They have been affronted. They have not been taken seriously about their exegesis on the subject or their doctrinal thesis on the subject. And they know they're right. And they've spent a lot of time developing this and a lot of energy, and they're wanting something for that. They want a return on it. And when they're not, they feel insulted. They feel injured because you don't believe the same way they do. You don't go along with it. So they've been insulted. Their intelligence has been insulted. And by the way, they know. They're full of knowledge. So they've been slighted. And the word comes from a French word. It's pique, spelled P-I-Q-U-E, pronounced pique. And it means anger at being slighted and having a wounded pride. Because after all, when you sink a lot of energy and time and effort into coming up with these doctrinal theses, if you will, you just want everybody to feel the same way you do. And just get excited about it and just feel, you know, that you know, you're right. And it's not going to happen. Well, you know, there's a lot of things that I want people to believe that I do that, down through the years that I've just come to the conclusion that they're not going to. And this type of feeling breeds resentment. And I was watching a program the other day. Most of you are familiar with the man that worked for NBC. And I think he was in the sports area, that particular organization. And he and one of his older sons and his younger son were on a flight somewhere, and I think they crashed over around Colorado or somewhere, whatever, you know. And it killed the younger son. The older son survived along with the father. And the mother was Susan St. James, who, you know, was an actress and was on Macmillan and Wife and so on and so forth. But they were interviewing her, and she was so overwhelmed by the outpouring of concern and love and care of people she didn't even know, strangers, the gifts, the cards or whatever, you know, the letters and the phone calls. And she just wanted to get on TV and just say thank you. And they were doing kind of an interview with her. And the interviewer asked her, said, well, you know, this is a terrible thing that's happened to you and your family. It's just awful. And, you know, your children. You don't want to lose your children. He said, do you feel any resentment over it? And she looked at him and she said, no. So there's a saying in our family. And this is a saying. Resentment is like taking poison and hoping that the other person dies. When you read these chapters in Romans and Corinthians, you realize that the people on one side or the other are resentful. And it's just like they're the ones that's being harmed. They're the ones that have the detriment to them. Now, it may overflow, and then you may find out about their resentment towards you because you don't believe their doctrinal thesis or their exegesis on the particular subject. It may spread out to the fact that you may find out about it, and you may be affected. But most of all, it's going to affect them. And it's like taking poison and hoping that the other person dies. And I thought that was one of the most profound statements on that subject that I ever heard in my life. And I had to write it down because I don't remember so well anymore. But that's exactly what the Apostle Paul is saying here. You know, you people are despising each other. You're resenting each other. And it's poisoning the church. And it's having an effect that's going to cause problems even worse than they already are. But he says, verse 3 again, the one eating, do not despise the one not eating. And the one not eating, do not judge the one that does eat. Okay, so one group is despising, the other group is judging. And the word judgment here is this. It means to distinguish or discern. And that's okay. That's how we grow. That's how we learn. That's how we get knowledge. And that's how we get wisdom and understanding. By discerning. That's good. But it also means this. It means by implication to try, to condemn, and to punish. And when it goes that far, you become the judge, the juror, and the executioner. And that's not right. And it doesn't matter if you're right about the subject. And who's right here? Which side's right? Both. Which side's wrong? Both. One believes that they can, they should, and they can. One doesn't believe it, they better not. And they should not, because if they do, they're not doing it of faith, and that is sin. So they're both right, and they're both wrong, and Paul goes right down the middle, the eloquent man that he is, the politician, if you want to say that, that's okay. But he knows what's right for the church, he knows what's good for the church, and this is not right, this is not good, your feelings are not correct. And that's what happens when people just continue to push and insist on everybody else being on the same page on a, what we'll call a twiggy issue. Twiggy issues are those that you know, like Bronson James, if you remember, at the Feast of Tabernacles this year in Wagner, Oklahoma, gave a sermon. He talked about the twiggy issues where you can get so far off on those twigs that there's not much support on that branch and you can fall on your backside. You know, it never seems to amaze me that the issue about what you can and can't do on the Sabbath. Let's focus on what we can do. If you want to go out on the twig issues about the Sabbath, I know buying and selling is one of the big issues. Wait a minute. Let's get into buying and selling. Let's just drag it in. If you want to just completely quit buying and selling on the Sabbath, and we're all guilty of it, before sunset on Friday, go out to the water meter and turn your water off. You know what that means, don't you? On Friday evening, you're going to have to carry a bunch of 5-gallon buckets, carry them into the house, because we all want to flush the, okay? Get your tub, fill it up with water. Get all your cooking utensils and fill them up so that you can have drinking water. Because there's people working 24/7 to see that water pushes through that meter. And guess what that meter is? Every time you flush that toilet, that meter goes ka-ching. You can't get around it. You're buying and they're selling. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. If you've got a flood problem, you got to get rid of it. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. What about the gas meter? I don't advise you to turn that meter off because you have to relight the pilots and sometimes that can cause problems. I know because I work for a gas utility company. But you would have to do so on Friday evening. To keep from buying and selling. Yeah. 24/7 they work. And every time you turn on the pilot, you turn on the stove, you may have electronic pilots. Some of them have standing pilots where there's a pilot there all the time. That meter's turning. Now, you could go turn that meter off. You could avoid the situation. But you can't do that with electricity now. You gotta think this all the way through. Now, if we're going to carry this out to the very edge of that twig, we've got to think about that electric meter. Because you can't just turn your appliances off and think that I'm not using the electricity. No, you can't do that. Because guess what? When I turn my VCR off, when I turn my DVD player off, can't see it here, but mine's got this light that just keeps going just like this, on and off, on and off. There's electricity going through that box. When I turn my TV off, it keeps partially energized by electricity. And that meter out there is the cash register for that company that's selling me electricity. I was out of electricity 14 days back in the year of 2000, 2001. That's not fun. It's not fun for a day, much less 14. I got me a generator. I don't know how I do that on the Sabbath. I don't know if I could crank that generator up or not. But anyway, I just want to let you know that there's all kinds of issues that we could bring up. I've got one, a good one. in my opinion. It happened, I don't know, several months ago. I decided that when I go to my prayer closet now, I'm not going to try to convert you on this, but I just want to let you know that I could bring up issues and everybody else can. I decided when I go to my prayer closet, I need to take my shoes off. Anybody ever else do that? You don't do that? You really need to. Let me tell you why. No, I'm just kidding. It's just something that I thought about, and I think, you know, this is really twiggy and twerpy, but when I finally think through the whole process and go through the whole study on it, I'll probably say, well, you know, it really doesn't matter. But I could make it an issue, and I told my congregation last week in Texarkana, I could actually tell the men coming up for the opening, closing prayers, before they come up to that lectern and do that prayer, if they take their shoes off. And my reason for thinking that is that, you know, remember Moses came up before God and the burning bush and all the things in the mountain. He said, you know, take your shoes off where you're standing holy ground. I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. When I go to my prayer closet, I'm going up to the throne of God in His presence. With Jesus Christ at His right hand making intercession for me, I need to take my shoes off. That's just, hey, I know I'm probably way out there on the twig. I know I'm on a twig. I'm on a twig. But it's my own personal little quirk, okay? Grant me mine. You got yours. And I'm not going to force that on you, but I thought, you know, just I throw that out for you because there's a lot of things that we could really make issues out of that really shouldn't be. This is the same thing here. Both sides are right. Both are wrong. If you don't believe you should, you shouldn't. If you do believe you should. Okay? It continues here by saying, who are you, verse 4, judging another servant? To his own master he stands or falls, but he will stand. Both sides will stand. For God is able to make him stand. One indeed judges the day above another, another day. Let's drop down. Verse 7, no one lives to himself and no one dies to himself. For we both live and we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. Then if we live and if we die, we are the Lord's. For this both Christ died and rose and lived again, that he might be the Lord of both the dead and the living. But why do you judge your brother? Leave him alone. And I could tell you things about people that on the Sabbath that they notice, you know, they're probably the only ones that have these certain issues, but it's theirs, and they're okay with it, and they're not trying to push it for me, and I'm not trying to convert them. And we get along just very well together. That's the way it should be. Now, why is it then, let's go to the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 8th chapter. Why is it then that these issues keep coming up year after year after year? I mean, after a couple thousand years of the New Testament Church of God, you'd think that they would have all the issues ironed out and everything would be smoothed over and we'd all be on the same page and we'd all understand the same thing and be doing everything alike. But it seems like we never get it right, that things keep coming up and issues keep burning in people's minds. Well, I'll tell you why. It's kind of like a Willie Nelson. Now, you folks in East Texas know Willie Nelson. He's one of them old, quote-unquote, good old boys from East Texas. Willie had habits, and his friends had habits. And Willie wrote a song about their habits. And I think the song was entitled, Reasons to Quit. Their bad habits. And he went through this whole litany of reasons why he should quit smoking left-handed cigarettes, as they call it in certain corners of the country. You know, the herbal stuff. And reasons why his friends should quit drinking, and he should quit drinking. But his whole conclusion to the end of the song was that, well, the reasons we don't is because there's so many reasons why. And when somebody keeps pushing issues at you, it's because they're getting a return on it. If they stop getting a return, then they might stop. But Willie was getting a return on his herbal medicine and his liquid spirits, and so were his friends. So as long as they got some kind of return on it, they would keep it up. Now, issues in the church die out when there's no return on it. Now, it makes the people mad. It makes them upset because, you know, they spent all this time and energy and effort into it, and then they got enough effort out of that. They got enough, you know, buzz out of that or whatever, but then they want everybody else to feel the same way, so they keep pushing the issue. But if it dies out, then it will stop. But it keeps coming up because there is return on these people's investments that have these doctrinal theses that they want to expound to everyone. Proverbs 8. Let's look at this a little bit further. And I want to start in the first verse. Here, wisdom is being personified as a person. She stands at the top of the high places. Verse 2, by the way of the places of the past. She cries at the gate. She says, here I am. I want to give it to you. And these people are saying, here I am. I've got this great doctrinal thesis that I want to just share with you and enlighten you to the point where you're just as wise and smart as I am. You know, that's, you know, and most of us go along every Sabbath and we don't think that way. Some do. Some do, to the point where they'll either leave the church or they'll leave and take others with them. And that's not what it's all about. That's not what the Church of God is about. That's not what the Church of God and National is all about. We're more like Paul. We're into building churches, not bringing them down. Tools, whether it be knowledge or anything else, is kind of like a saw. Now, you cannot build a house without a saw. You have to cut the tubifores. You have to cut the plates, you know, the bottom plates, the top plates. And you have to, for example, if you frame a house up, you've got to cut these braces and you've got to tack them to the ground and to the thing that holds the walls up until you get the trusses up. You know, the trusses actually hold the walls up and keep them from falling down. Now, if a person goes through all this effort to frame this house and puts the braces up to keep the walls up until he gets the trusses up there, you can take that same saw that you used to build those walls with, and you cut those braces, and a big stiff wind comes along, and guess what happens? It all comes coming down. So tools, whether it be knowledge or anything else, have two sides, two edges, if you will, two faces, and can be used for good or for bad. Here, wisdom personified says, continuing, let's say, verse 5, oh, you simple, understand wisdom. You know, that's kind of what the guy that's resentful, he said, you know, you simple people, let me enlighten you and show you some wisdom. And you fools, be you of an understanding heart. Here, for I will speak of excellent things, great, lofty, knowledgeable theses, if you will. And he says, I speak of excellent things, and the opening of my lips shall be right things. For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. Now, really, wisdom is that way, true wisdom, applied correctly. Verse 8, all the words of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing forward or perverse in them. Applied correctly, that is true. Now, verse 12. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge of witty inventions. The word prudence here means to discretion or good judgment. Witty inventions. I think the word is pronounced sagacity. I may be wrong about that pronunciation, but if I am, forgive me, I hated English. But actually, witty inventions, because I don't understand King James witty inventions. I don't, you know, that don't do much for me. So I decided to look it up, and actually it means sound judgment or mental acuteness. Now, I can sink my teeth into those words. I can understand what that means. Now, verse 13, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogancy, and the evil way, and the forward mouth. Do I hate? The forward mouth means perverted speech. And a lot of these things that come down the pipes and keep resurfacing are a perverted speech, a perverted way of seeing things, a one-sided coin, if you will, one-sided issue. So we need to avoid those things. Now, chapter 10 and verse 11. Chapter 10, beginning verse 11. The mouth of a righteous man is a well of life. You know, Paul was just like a pendulum. Before his conversion toward the church of God, he was way over here. Way over here. Way out of line. After his conversion, he was way on the other end. He was such a loving and merciful and kind and patient father of the churches that he oversaw. It was like daylight and dark. And here it says here, the man, a righteous man is a well of life, but violence covers the mouth of the wicked. You know, what's the Church of God about? It's about building. It's about encouraging. It's about exhorting sometimes. But it's not about bringing down or destruction. Continuing, he says, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. All of them. He says here that verse 13, in the lips of him that has understanding, wisdom is found, but a rod is for the back of him that is void of understanding. Wise men lay up knowledge, but the mouth of the foolish is near destruction. Chapter 16, verse 18. pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. You remember we said about the person that despised the other group? He was full of pride. He was arrogant. He was resentful. He continues by saying, better is it to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. You know, I've seen it more times than not that the ministry in the Church of God International is more of a humble spirit. They're ones that's not wanting to push any issue other than just salvational issues, the ones that really matter. But the twiggy issues, like Mr. Stinson mentioned last week, I just soon not have to deal with them because, you know, it's just sometimes in dealing with them, you're going to make somebody upset. But sometimes you just have to. And that's where it's at. We get pushed to the point where we have to deal with things sometimes when we just rather not. And our time is involved in things that are less edifying for everyone involved. But it happens sometimes. Verse 23, the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds learning to his lips. You know, he's just discretionary about what he believes. He takes in consideration that the other person just may not believe that same way. So therefore, he's not going to bring up a point of contention. After I once learned somebody has a certain issue or a certain understanding that's different than mine, if it's not salvational, I don't bring it up. I avoid it. Because it doesn't really matter one way or the other. They're okay with it, and I'm certainly okay. Let's go to, chapter 11, and begin verse 9. A hypocrite with his neighbor destroys his neighbor, but through knowledge shall the just be delivered. When it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices, and when the wicked perish, there is shouting. By the blessing of the upright, the city is exalted, but is overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. He that is void of wisdom despises his neighbor, but a man of understanding holds his peace. And the issues that were brought up in Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians 8, you know, the despising of one side or the other, the judgment on one side or the other, there's problems with that. Deep, heavy problems. And they could lead to salvational issues. The issues of themselves were not salvational, but they could lead to that. Now, James, the third chapter. This is what the Apostle James has to say about the situation. Verses 1 through 6, he talks about the tongue being an unruly evil. It kindles a big fire. It's just a little instrument, but it kindles a great fire. I want to drop down now to verse 13, though. Who is a wise man endued with knowledge? And knowledge brings power. And with that, hopefully you get understanding and compassion and patience and mercy and graciousness that Jesus Christ and God have for us that show us every day of our lives. Because after all, if he didn't show that towards us, would we be here today? Probably not. If he wanted exact punishment, he could have done it a long time ago. But he was patient and kind and merciful and gracious and brought us forth to where we're at today. But who is endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conduct his works with meekness of wisdom. You know, there may be something that I know that you don't know. So what? What I do know, God brought forth to me, especially when it comes to the engrafted Word of God. He showed it to me. He told me, as we first read in Matthew 13, it's given to you. I didn't acquire that on my own. God gave it to me. Where was my boasting? He continues by saying, verse 15, this wisdom descends not from, verse 14, he says, but if you have bitter envy and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descends not from above, but is earthly, sensual, and devilish. For where envy and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. And when that person who is not receiving return on his investment of his doctrinal thesis, his exegesis, or whatever you want to call it, he will cease to bring it forward. Verse 17, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. Paul was a peacemaker. He endeavored to keep the peace. There are a lot of things that God hates. Let's go back to the book of Proverbs, and we're going to conclude here in another couple of verses. But Proverbs, I want to go back to it because it says so much about what God thinks about certain issues being pushed to the point where they're contentious and they're not really salvational of nature. Proverbs 6, beginning verse 12 says, a naughty person, a wicked man, walks with a forward mouth. He winks with his eyes and he speaks with his feet. He teaches with his fingers. Forwardness is in his heart. He devises mischief and continually. He sows discord. Verse 15, therefore shall his calamity come suddenly. Suddenly shall he be broken without remedy. These six things does the Lord hate. Yes, seven are an abomination unto him. A proud look. You know, the Barney Fife look. Barney was harmless, okay? That's okay. We can be harmless in our pride, but then there's the pride that brings down brethren, brings down churches. And, you know, a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaks lies, and he that sows discord among the brethren. These things God hates. And it doesn't matter if you're right and you misapply it or if you're wrong. He still hates it one way or the other if it breeds discord. Now, in Ephesians, the fourth chapter, Ephesians 4, if I can find that book. Again, the Apostle Paul dealing with the church in Ephesus. And remember what Apostle Paul said about the Ephesian elders in the book of Acts? He said, you know, even of your own selves will some come in not sparing the flock, grievous wolves. You know, we don't want that in the ministry. We certainly don't want it in the brethren, in the congregations, among anyone. That's not what it's all about. We as architects or designers, if you will, in a manner of speaking, builders of a church, would never want to do anything that would bring it down. And I know everybody feels that way, or at least 99% of us. Ephesians 4, beginning verse 1, it says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you were called, with all lowliness and meekness and long-suffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. Verse 11, he gave some apostles, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. In other words, the building of the church of Christ, the church of God. Instruments we are in God's hands. For the perfecting of the saints, I read that. Verse 13, till we all come into unity of the faith. And we're not there yet. We're not exactly on the same page and everything. But until we do, it says, the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive, maybe not knowing so, what they do. With that in mind, I'm going to conclude with Proverbs, the 12th chapter, verses 16 through 20. What's the church of God all about? What are we trying to accomplish? Well, we're just like the architects and the engineers who are trying to build a structure, a temple, with God's certainly divine guidance. Because we can't do it without God's divine guidance. But we're in it together. And this is what we're about. Proverbs 12, beginning in verse 16. A fool's wrath is presently known, but a prudent man covers shame. He that speaks truth shows forth righteousness, but a false witness deceit. There is that speaks like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise is health. The knowledge, the two-edged sword. It can be used to good or it can be used to pierce like a sword. Verse 19, the lips of truth shall be established forever. But a lying tongue is but for a moment. Deceit is the heart of them that imagine evil. But to the counselors of peace is joy. Really, we are counselors of peace. That's what we like in congregations. That's what we like in the church. And that's what we're pursuing. That's what we're trying to devise and to build, a church. that is at peace with one another and not contention.